Hare Krishna. So today we're reading from Canto 1, Chapter 4, Text 20 to 23. So I'll just recite the English for verses 20 to 22, and then we'll go on to 23. I was going to do that after I recite the verse. Yeah. Okay. So text 20. The four divisions of the original sources of knowledge, the Vedas, were made separately. But the historical facts and authentic stories mentioned in the Puranas are called the fifth Veda. Text 21. After the Vedas were divided into four divisions, Baila Rishi became the professor of the Rig Veda, Jaimini the professor of the Samaveda, and Vaishampayan alone became glorified by the Yajur Veda. Purport. The different Vedas were entrusted to different learned scholars for development in different ways. Text 22. The Sumantu Muni Angira, who was very devotedly engaged, was entrusted with the Atharva Veda, and my father, Romaharshana, was entrusted with the Puranas and historical records. Purport. In the Shruti Mantras also, it is stated that Angira Muni, who strictly followed the rigid principles of the Atharva Veda, was the leader of the followers of the Atharva Veda. So now we come to text 23. Yeah. All these learned scholars in their turn rendered their entrusted Vedas unto the many disciples, grand disciples and great grand disciples, and thus the respective branches of the followers of the Vedas came into being. Purport given by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada ki. The original source of knowledge is the Vedas. There are no branches of knowledge, either mundane or transcendental, which do not belong to the original text of the Vedas. They have simply been developed into different branches. They were originally rendered by great, respectable, and learned professors. In other words, the Vedic knowledge, broken into different branches by different disciplic successions, has been distributed all over the world. No one, therefore, can claim independent knowledge beyond the Vedas. Daita Rishayo Vedam Swam Sam Vyasyanane Khada Shishye Prashishye Stakshisher Vedaste Shakino Bhavan. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Okay, Hare Krishna. So this is my second class in the morning Bhagavatam sessions. This is actually more nerve-wracking than the first one, because the first one was doing the marathon, so there wasn't many devotees here. And then today I come in and there's all these wonderful Vaishnavas, and particularly a lot of senior Vaishnavas are here. I just saw Rasamanda Prabhu here after a long time. So, and of course Vishambha Prabhu, Jayadev Prabhu, Mataji. So it's a bit nerve-wracking, to be honest. But I'll do my best. It's cliched, and it's a very cliched thing to say. I'm not qualified to sit here, but at the same time, it's Kali Yuga. We have to do our best to push on the movement, and I'm just going to do my best to just repeat what Prabhupada has said and what the great devotees have said, and just without any kind of own concoctions on this verse. So please bless me and forgive me for any mistakes that I make. Hare Krishna. Okay, so it's a very interesting verse. You can see that these last few verses, they're basically talking about the delineation of the Vedas. It's the dawn of the Kali Yuga, just about to happen. Vedavyas sees that obviously the grand mass of population is diminished in intelligence. The oral tradition by which they would naturally receive the knowledge in previous times is not relevant for this age. So they decide to put it in literary format. And Vedavyas, he compiled it with the help of his disciples and grand disciples, and they split the Vedas into different sections. And then what Prabhupada is saying here is that these Vedas that are split are then actually spread throughout the whole world. So there's a few things that Prabhupada says here, which I thought is interesting. Number one, the Vedas is the original source of all knowledge, mundane and transcendental. That's very interesting. And it also says that it's been distributed all over the world. This is a very, very deep verse, and like all the Bhagavatam verses, they're so pregnant with meaning that it's not possible to convey the entirety of what the verse is talking about in half an hour. So I'm just going to pick a few points and just some simple thoughts, realizations that are coming from this. So I'm going to look at this, these two statements, that the Vedas is the source of all knowledge and that it's spread all over the world. I'm going to see it from three perspectives. Firstly, from the ancient Vedic perspective. Then I'm going to look at it from the post-Vedic historical perspective. And then I'm going to look at it from the practical perspective for the present and the future. What do we do with this understanding about the Vedas? How do we relate to it? So let's start with the ancient Vedic perspective. We understand that Krishna, as Vishnu, imparted this knowledge to Lord Brahma at the dawn of creation. And using this knowledge, Lord Brahma then practically created the whole material cosmos, all the planets and things like that. And then what happened is that the understanding is that when the spirit soul comes into the material world, he has many desires to fulfill. This material world is like an arena for the spirit soul to fulfill his desires to be like a little Krishna himself. I often give the example that just like when the mom is cooking on the cooker, and then you have the little daughter. I'm sure some of you have children will know this. You know, sometimes the little daughter will try and impersonate the mother. So she'll have her own little toy cooker and toy pots. She tries to pretend to be the mum, right? She's cooking there on the kitchen floor and everything. And after about 20 minutes or so, she gets bored. She realizes nothing much there. Then she goes off to play with her plasticine or something, right? So in the same way, we are like that little children. We're here in the mature cosmos, trying to be Krishna, trying to lord it over the mature world, trying to enjoy independently of Krishna. Now the problem is, of course, that in the mature world, there are a lot of clauses that you have to go by, and namely the laws of karma. So it's based on cause and effect. So whatever you do here has a reaction to it. Krishna knows that. So therefore, he gives the Vedas as a means for us to live out our desires in the material cosmos, and at the same time incurring the least amount of damage possible. So it's a damage limitation procedure. Okay? Just like, and this is the difference between, let's say, a person following the Vedas and, let's say, an out-and-out demon. The desires of, let's say, a demonic personality and a person following the Vedas, it's practically the same. They want happiness, they want prestige, they want power, status, all these things. But the difference is, do you follow the rules to get what you want, or do you just disregard the rules and trample over people and then do it? Right? It's the same like, again, common example, I want to drive from here to Leicester, right? I can either follow the highway code to get to Leicester, or I can disregard everything, just drive across the motorway, across the fields, across people's hedges, crashing into people and cows, and then get to Leicester. I've reached my goal, but the point is that on one level, because I disregarded the highway codes, I'm going to get a lot of serious reactions for it. So 90% of the Vedas is actually to do with making us more materially situated, comfortable in the material world. Okay? So the Vedas, like it says here, is the source of all knowledge, mundane and transcendental. So the Vedas actually mainly to do with a lot of mundane knowledge. There are books in the Vedas that talk about medicine, health, wealth, how to get power. There are prayers in the Vedas dedicated to Agnidev to get power. There are prayers dedicated to Indra to get to maximize your sensual enjoyment. And there are prayers dedicated to Saraswati Devi. These are all demigods, representatives of Krishna. And he prayed to these people for different material benedictions. Right? And of course, we know from the scriptures, demons are very fond of this. They use the Vedas to get as much material benefit as they can. Right? Now, what happens when the living entity goes through life? He decides to follow after many lives, when he does get a human form of life, that is, right? Then he decides to follow the Vedas. He thinks that, yes, I'm going to follow the Vedas, fulfill my desires, but in the right way, right? Without the least possible bad karma. So he goes through this. Life after life, he's trying to enjoy himself. He does this yajna, that ritual, that mantra. And then he comes to the realization that no matter how much I'm trying to satisfy myself, it's not really giving me the full happiness that I crave. Because the eternal function of the soul is to be Sat Chit Ananda, full of eternity, full of knowledge, full of bliss. No matter what you do in this material world, you're not going to fulfill that. So then he realized that all the material world, all the material enjoyment in this world is Chapala Sukha. It's temporary and it's limited. At that point, the living entity then comes to the realization that, you know what? Where do I go for that source of eternal happiness that's not going to let me down, that's not going to diminish, that's not going to fall below my expectations? And that's where the other 10% of the Vedas comes in. So, you know, I mentioned that 90% of the Vedas do with material stuff, what we call karmakanda. Then there's a 10%, which is the transcendental aspect, right? And that's when the human entity, the living entity, actually starts to question, what is beyond this world? What is actually the source of this reality? How do I attain that? And so this is the first verse of the Vedanta Sutra. Athata Brahma Jigyasa. Jigyas means to question. Brahma means a Brahman, the supreme reality. And this is where the other 10% comes in. So it's said that this material and spiritual knowledge that's coming from Vedas eventually percolated down the ages and, you know, spread throughout the world. According to the Vedas, the truths that we're experiencing, they're coming because they're directly from Krishna. They're beyond the four defects of the human person, which is the propensity to cheat, to steal, to commit mistakes, and imperfect senses. So the Vedas are known as apurusheya, which means that they're beyond these four defects. So they're considered perfect. So everything that's coming from the Vedas is also considered to be perfect. There are three main divisions within the Vedas. You got Karmakand, Jnanakand, Upasanakand. Karmakand is what we just described now. You work for some fruitive results, but adhering to the Vedas. Then, when you decide that you want to go beyond that, I want to experience something deeper, then you go to Jnanakand, which is trying to understand the supreme truth, but through your own speculation. So there's still an element of controllership there. Okay, you're still trying to do it through your own way. And then, above that, you got Upasanakand, which is basically worshipping the Vedas to get to Krishna. You do still have some worship towards demigods, but again, it's in relation to Krishna, not just to get to some sort of, demigod benedictions or anything like that. So now the question is that when you look at the world right now and you see so many different religious traditions, spiritual traditions, how can you link it with the Vedas? Because some of them seem very different. Okay? So the Vedas is very all-encompassing. You have the scriptures and the Vedas that cater to people in different modes of nature, goodness, passion, ignorance. Externally, it may seem that the knowledge in the Vedas seems contradictory. For example, as Vaishnavas, we don't eat meat, but there are Vedic scriptures that give injunctions on how to eat meat properly, right? But you have to look at it from a higher perspective, that looking at where the people are and then bringing them up to a higher level, okay? We see that also in chapter 12 of the Bhagavad Gita, where it says, if you can't do devotional service, then do this. If you can't do this, then do this. Like this, it goes lower and lower in the level until you get to the level of just doing mundane charitable works. Okay? So the Vedas is catering for people of different tastes. And sometimes when you go from one level of the Vedas to a higher level, then it seems that you're going through a contradiction. But it's not actually a contradiction. It's just a higher level understanding. Like Krishna tells Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, that you follow the Vedas so you can get a place in the heavenly planet. So do fight in this war. Fight in this war so you can get glory and honor and a heavenly place. But then literally a few verses later, he's saying that forget these materialistic aims. Forget the flowery words of the Vedas. Just fight for me. So within the Vedas itself, you find there's higher levels of understanding which may apparently contradict each other. You see this in the modern world. Like, for example, the other day, Nikhil was saying that when he studied chemistry at school, at GCSE level, when they talk about the structure of the atom, it's protons, neutrons, and electrons. But then, as you progress in the understanding, when you get to A-level chemistry, then the whole thing switches, and then you've got these things called neutrinos, right? And the neutrinos completely changes the structure of how an atom is working. And then, of course, if you go even higher than that, you get to quantum physics and things, then even the nature of how a particle moves changes. Right? It doesn't just go in waves, it may go in straight lines, etc. So there's all these different levels of understanding which may initially contradict, but we have to look at it from a different perspective. So if you look at the mundane knowledge that the Vedas gives, actually a lot of the modern knowledge that we have in the world reaches from the Vedas. The Western civilization, a lot of the systems of knowledge they got was from the Middle East, from the Arabs. Right? So for example, the decimal system, the numeral system, the laws of trigonometry, of course, Pythagoras' theorem is often attributed to, obviously, Pythagoras. But actually, the knowledge that a squared equals b squared plus b c squared root under was actually there existing before in the Vedic scriptures. So actually, one of the Arab scholars himself, Al-Biruni, who incidentally didn't even like Hindus at the time, because that's the time when the Arab invasions were happening in India, right? So he was an iconoclast. He didn't like the idea of deity worship, things like that. But even he acknowledged that actually the knowledge that we're getting now, which is making this Arab civilization great, because, you know, at that time, Middle Eastern civilization was soaring. He actually said that, you know what, it's actually coming from India, right? The decimal point. They had knowledge on how to perform open heart surgery, how to sort of, you know, like align the planets, the planetary systems. And even now, modern science, the way in which you're looking at the measurements of the different planets, it actually matches what the Vedic scriptures say. Not that we're using modern science to validate us, but it's just a point of interest that actually there is a lot of commonality there. Okay? So in Canto 11, it's said that from the forefathers, headed by Bhrigu Muni and other sons of Brahma, many, many different entities appeared, like demigods, demons, humans, siddhas, gandharas, guyakas, nagas, kinaras, etc. And all of them, all these universal species have their respective leaders with their different natures generated from different modes of nature. And therefore they have different desires. And because of this, there are different Vedic rituals and rewards that are geared towards these different entities all across the universe. So we get the picture that there's countless races and societies all across the universe with their different natures, and the Vedic scriptures are catering to all of them. So we cannot just limit the Vedic scriptures right now to just a particular set of Sanskrit texts that are just in India right now. Okay? They're all over. Richard L. Thompson, Sadaputa Prabhu, has done a lot of work on this about the kind of cross-cultural traces of Vedic civilization. Okay, so the point is, from the Vedic system, everything is coming from there. And right now, when we're practicing Krishna consciousness, even if we cannot realize the commonality yet, even if we cannot realize the truths that are in the Vedas, if we practice the process, then eventually the realizations come. Until then, we accept them as axiomatic truths. Axiomatic means that they're a universally accepted truth, like we accept that everyone in this world is going to die. Right? Now, we don't have to go around and, you know, check all the 7 billion people in this world that are they going to die or not. We just accept it as a given fact. So a lot of the things in the Vedas we accept as given. Okay, so that's the ancient Vedic perspective. Now we're going to move on to the post-Vedic historical perspective. This is what is being propagated since the dawn of Kali Yuga and subsequently afterwards. And it's very much contradictory to what I've just spoken now. Okay, so what I'm spoken now is this, okay, Vedas is everything, the source of everything. The contemporary historical perspective varies in a lot of ways. Number one, they believe, especially in the mainstream science history books, that humans did not exist for millions and millions of years. They've only existed for maybe 40, 50,000 years. Before that we were Homo sapiens now. Before that we were Homo robustus, Homo erectus, hunter-gatherers. Civilization only started basically from, you know, Babylon, Sumeria, Mesopotamia, things like that. That's the dawn of it, right? Another thing that the modern historical perspective would say is that the civilization we have now is the most advanced, most accomplished civilization we've ever had, because we've got our smartphones, we've got nice roads and big steel buildings and you know, satellite dishes and all the rest of it, right? So that's another contradiction. And another one is, they say, is that there's only civilization on Earth. There are not civilization existing in other parts of the universe. So if you look at the Vedas, it's going completely against all these things. Okay, we do believe that actually, no, humanity now is actually a lot less intelligent and more degraded than what previous civilizations were. We have been existing here for millions and millions of years. And also, that there are civilizations existing on other parts of the universe. So how do we reconcile these two things? There's another thing that the mainstream academia also is based on, which is that the Vedas came from a group of nomads originating in Central Asia called the Aryans. I don't know if you've heard of this, the Aryan-Dravidian theory. And these Aryans, they came into the area of that is now the subcontinent, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and then they invaded, destroyed the original primitive culture there. That was known as the Dravidians or the Dasus, and then they implanted their knowledge, and then what you have now, the Vedic civilization, is a mixture between the Aryans and the Dravidians combining together. And they also said that the Aryans invaded around 1500 to 1000 BC. If that's true, that means everything that has been spoken of in this verse is completely false, right? So the stakes are very high here. Now, as devotees, we may take this knowledge in the Vedas, that is, Prabhupada is saying in the Vedic scriptures, as for granted. But the problem is, in the modern academic sphere, in the media, if you look at the history of the subcontinent, if you look at the history of Vedic culture, this Aryan Dravidian theory is very, very prevalent. Now, at the moment, there is a lot of questioning done on it by a lot of academics that maybe it's not so true, right? But at the same time, there's a lot of work to be done. If we're going to propagate Krishna consciousness around the world, then there's a lot of big intellectual, mental blocks that we have to go over. And what's the interesting thing is that this Aryan Dravidian theory is not just prevalent in the West. A lot of the Indian academia and the Indian scientific societies, they also buy into this theory as well. The reason for it is, well, I'm just going to give a little historical snapshot here. When the British went to India initially, they were very enamored with the Indian culture. A lot of them learned Sanskrit. They studied the scriptures. They really wanted to know it, and they had a lot of appreciation for the Vedas. They even said that this Vedic scriptures is a lot more sophisticated and developed than what we've had, you know, which is the kind of book of Genesis and Christianity and things like that. What happened, though, is as time progressed, as the decades progressed, and commercial interests came to play, and religious interests, particularly from the clergy of Britain, then they felt that actually, you know what, this Vedic knowledge is a threat to our dominion over this land, right? So then they started to see how they can undermine the Vedas, how they can negate it. Jai Sri Sri Radha Gokulananda ki, Sitaram Lakshmana Hanuman Sri Sri Gaunitai ki. So they decided that how can we actually undermine it, right? How can we negate it? So then what they did was they started to pick, nitpick a lot of the kind of supernatural aspects of the Vedas and used to say that this is all hocus pocus. And then at that point, they started to bring in this Aryan Dravidian theory. Okay? What does Prabhupada actually say about the meaning of the word Aryan? Because the Aryan word has been used a lot in society. The Nazis hijacked it to say it's a, you know, master blonde-haired, blue-eyed master race. Before that, the British Indologists were using it to say that they're a bunch of, fair-skinned nomads from Central Asia that came and imparted it to these primitive people. So if you look at chapter 2 of the Gita, verse 2, the purport, Prabhupada says that the word Aryan is applicable to people who know the value of life and have a civilization based on spiritual realization. So it's not based on the race, it's not based on a geographical area. It's based on your state of consciousness and how much you're living according to principles of the Vedas. What's more, if you look at the Aryan Dravidian theory, even though it's considered almost gospel in a lot of the academic spheres, it actually has no validity. They base it on linguistics, that, for example, the language developed. But the linguistic conjectures that they make are completely unsubstantiated. Not only that, in the Vedic scriptures themselves, there's no record of an invasion happening into the area of India now from abroad. What's more, they're saying that this Aryan Dravidian theory took place 1500 BC. That would be after Abraham and his people came, you know, in the biblical scriptures. So you're saying that the Vedas contain so much deep knowledge, but they conveniently forgot to mention about this great mass exodus, right? The Vedic scriptures say that, even though the other biblical scriptures have mentioned their records, which supposedly come from before. It does not make any sense. Also, the understanding that there's a cultural continuity, the measurements that they're giving of when the Aryan Dravidian theory came, and now the modern archaeological research that's being done into the Indian civilization that is going before 1500 BC shows that there's a cultural continuity in the artifacts, the rituals that have been practiced before the supposed Aryan invasion happened. Does that make sense? Right? So they're saying the Aryan invasion happened 1500 BC, and that's when the thing started. But now archaeological research is saying that no, we have done research that's going into archaeological relics and stuff that's going beyond the 1500 BC mark, and it shows that there's a continuity in the way the civilizations are developing. So again, that also debunks this theory that the Aryans came and just did it. Okay? So that's the kind of contradiction that we're going to have to deal with in the modern society. Let's look at more commonalities between the idea that the Vedas have arisen and given understanding of how the modern civilizations are going. One thing that Prabhupada says is that in the olden days, there was an empire called Bharatvarsha, and the center was Hastinapur, and Yudhishthira is ruling from there. And so the Vedic culture is propagated all over the world. So the questions, and this is raised to Chaitanya Charanprabhu, that if that's so, how comes that you have civilizations in the world right now, like the Egyptian civilization, where they have their sphinxes, their pharaohs, which is considered to be more than 5,000 years old? You have the Chinese civilization, which is also more than 5,000 years, because it's before the time of Buddha, like Buddhist civilization. How is it that when you see these civilizations, they don't seem to have so much correlation with the Vedic literature, the Vedic understanding, the Vedic history and things like that? So one thing is that just like now, the modern power in the world would say, let's say, is America. America's influence is far-reaching all over the world through the media. Most people are adhering to American culture and customs, but it's not fully. See, if you go to places like China, India, you find that they have some culture which is their own, the indigenous culture, mixed with American values and stuff. In the same way, when Yudhishthira is ruling over different parts of the world, it's not that all the parts of the world were Xerox copies of the Vedic civilization practiced in India. They had their own cultures and customs as well. But if you look at all the different texts from Egypt, China, they all have certain commonalities. They believe in the soul. They believe in karma. They believe in reincarnation. So if you have these certain commonalities, then there is some sort of Vedic paradigm there that is going on. The language may be different. The rituals may be different. Their heroes may be different. Like in Egypt, they mummify the bodies, whereas in Vedic system, we cremate. But the main theological paradigms are still the same as what is practiced in India. So therefore, there's no need for Yudhishthira to go and impose his own particular cultural specific way of Vedic culture onto these other civilizations, because they're already practicing the essential aspects of the Vedas, right? Which, of course, we know from the ancient perspective was already, you know, percolated down there from way back, right? Dutta Karma Prabhu also speaks that in the pre-Christian world, you had the human realm, the higher celestial realm, and the spiritual realm. Isn't that reminiscent of what is spoken in the Vedas? There's the human realm, the celestial realm, and the spiritual realm. Okay, so in the third canto of the Bhagavatam, Brahma is actually saying himself that, my Lord, your devotees can see you through the ears by the process of bona fide hearing, and their hearts become cleansed. And you're so merciful to your devotees that you manifest yourself in the particular eternal form of transcendence through which they can see you. So the Lord will manifest himself through two different people of different civilizations based on their understanding of how they see God. We see that in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, when Gopa Kumar is traveling through the different planets of the spiritual world, the different Vaikuntha planets, you see that there are planets where, let's say, the Lord has taken on of a dog form, right? Like a dog-like features, and the inhabitants there have got dog-like features. Or there's a form where, like, you know, like sort of animal-like forms or this-like form, you know, all these different things. And Krishna himself even says that I descend in all the species of life. So therefore, you have to understand from a bigger perspective that Krishna is manifesting the Vedas through the different civilizations, but it's adapted according to the culture in which they're born and the culture in which they're raised. Okay? I'll give you a little account there. Again, so this is obviously certain commonalities that we can see. Now, one thing that people may say is that you see a lot of the times that a lot of the stories in different civilizations are very similar, or the way in which angels or celestial beings interact with human beings is very similar. For example, you know the story of Dukhi Krishna Das? Dukhi Krishna, that he was sweeping the area of Vrindavan, and they found an anklet. And then an old lady comes to him saying that this is my daughter's anklet. And then eventually it transpires that this old lady is actually Lalita Devi. and she manifests her eternal beautiful form. And later on, she again appears in Dukhi Krishna Das's meditations. So through this, we can see that in all spiritual scriptures, whether it's the Bible, the Vedas, or other scriptures, that high-level beings that interact with humans through telepathy, levitation, going through solid matter. There's a commonality. But the personalities may be different, right? In the biblical scriptures, it could be Gabriel or things like that. In our case, it's Lalita Devi, things like that. So again, Sadaputta Prabhu mentions that there's the possibility that there's a divine control system within the universe that maintains administrative systems for different religions, right? So what is this divine control system that he's alluding to? It's the Vedas. The Vedas is a divine control system and is looking at the different civilizations across the world and giving the same knowledge, but in a way that those people can relate to according to their nature and their culture that they're born into. But it goes deeper than that, because we can say that it could be different personalities, it could be the same personalities, but over time, the names have changed. For example, in the Assyrian texts, which started 5,000 years ago, they talk about a great war that happened east. And the chapter starts with the crying of the widows, because a lot of the warriors did not come back. So what big war happened 5,000 years ago? Kurukshetra war, right? Where millions and millions of people died. They say that, okay, it was 640 million people died, but actually I recently read this book, Commentary on the Mahabharata, by one of our devotees that said, actually it's 1,640 million people died. So that's a lot of people, right? And the warriors came from all over the world. There were different tribes fighting in the war. It wasn't just an Indian thing, it was a global thing. There were people from a place called Madradesh, which is where Madri's from. You know, she's the wife of Pandu. Madra, people often think, is Madras. It's not actually Madras. It's actually where is now modern-day Jerusalem, Israel, these area. You had people from Gandhar, which is now modern-day Kandahar, which is where Gandhar is from. You had a tribe called the Shin tribe, which is referred to in the Mahabharata as a yellow-skinned tribe from the east. And this Shin, over time, changed into Chin. And then Chin eventually became China. So you can see the global significance of the Mahabharata. It was a global thing. So there's a lot of Vedic connection going on there. Okay, there was a great ancient Greek scholar, and he tells the following story about the creation of the universe, of this world actually. He says that there was Virgo, the constellation Virgo, may belong to the star race, and that she would come in the golden age and tell people to speak the truth. Then from the golden age, it went into the silver age, the bronze age, the iron age. At each stage, the civilizations became more and more degraded until we get to the Iron Age, when it says that the man, this is not according to our scriptures, by the way, this is according to the ancient Greek scriptures, at which point the people invented the sword and they tasted the meat of the cows. And at that point, Virgo flew away. If you look at the ancient Native American Indians, the Sio tribe, they also talk about the four ages and how in the fourth age, there are such points as cow killing that's going to happen. Right? You look at the Nordic sagas, the Norse, they talk about four ages, and in these four ages, there's a progression. The first age is the age of peace, then in the second age, you have different social orders introduced. Interesting, what did the Vedas say about the Satyayuga? There was no social orders then, everyone was a hamsa. Then you get to the second age, when different social orders were introduced. Then you get to third age, where more violence starts coming in, until you get to the fourth age, when you get a knife age and an axe age with cloven shields. And then this is followed by a period of annihilation called Ragnarok. Right? Ragnarok is a time of annihilation where the whole thing burns, the world is destroyed by flames by a being named Surt, who lives beneath the lower world. What does Bhagavatam say about the same thing? At the end of Brahma's day, the devastation takes place due to the fire emanating from the mouth of Shankarsan, which is coming from underneath. So can you see that there's a lot of commonality even in the ancient legends and the scriptures or what's being said between the Vedas and other spiritual traditions? What do we take from this? So now we've covered the modern historical perspective, the contradictions, the issues, and the commonalities. So now we bring it to the modern stage. Now that we understood this, how do we relate with this? Are we here to now bring back Vedic society as it is? No, that's not possible. Kadmakanda Maharaj recently once said that Trying to bring back the Vedas is like a bunch of archaeologists trying to figure out a woolly mammoth by looking at a few bones, right? In the Antarctic or Arctic, sorry, or the northern Canada or wherever the woolly mammoth remains are. You cannot bring back the woolly mammoth. It's done, it's gone, right? So we're not trying to bring back Vedas. What the modern society is what is the purpose of the Vedas? Vedeshcha sarver aham eva vedyo. Vedanta krit vedavit eva chaham. The whole purpose of Vedas is to know Krishna. Forget all the other things, the mystic siddhis, the different medical knowledge and the material knowledge and all that. Prabhupada himself said that we don't need to know all this now. Material science has come to such a state that it's fine. You know, we can work with that. The whole point now is get to the cream, right? Which is to attain bhakti to Lord Krishna and get out of this whole place. That's the reason why when Prabhupada brought the Vedas to the West, he only brought that 10%, the transcendental literature. He didn't bother bringing the Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Atharva Veda. He just brought the Srimad Bhagavatam, the Bhagavad Gita, and of course the subsequent literatures like Chaitanya Charitamrita, things like that. Because he's saying that, look, we've been here so many lives, let's just get out of this place, this cycle of birth and death, go back to Krishna. In the Gaura Gunadesh, the Deepika, Kavi Karnapurna said actually that the 8 Siddhis, they become personified and they stand with folded hands at the feet of Bhakti Devi. So they're showing that you don't need to go for these mystic powers. Think about all these great, great rishis that have given up their mystic siddhis, that are meditating in the Himalayas now, right? Trying to attain Krishna. What would prompt them to give up absolute control of the fundamental laws of nature just to attain this bhakti, right? So we have the Vedic teachings, we respect them, but the analogy is given that the Vedas are like a goldsmith's hammer, right? You know, like little ting, 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 you know, little gentle little, like, you know, like taps here and there to mold the thing nicely, artistically. Whereas a modern, we're like, this is the Vedic school. What we are now in the modern Kali Yuga is in Gauranga school. So Gauranga school is like a blacksmith's hammer. How does a blacksmith's hammer go? It just whacks it hard, isn't it? Doesn't care about the niceties and the, you know, the little kind of like, you know, the little, what's the word? Yeah, the little subtleties. It's just going for shooting from the hip, right? It's just going straight for the jugular, right? That's what Gauranga school is doing. And the amazing thing about the Gauranga school is that it's giving the lowest of the low, which is basically us lot in Kali Yuga, the highest of the high. It's giving us the opportunity for what Bhagavatam says, Save pum samparo dharma yato bhakti adoksha je, ahe tuki apratihata yayatma suprasiditi. Unmotivated, uninterrupted devotional service, and that is the only thing that will fully satisfy the self. It's not that we need the Vedas to get to God, right? We only get to God, to Krishna, through the Lord's mercy. And in fact, the love for God is already within us, right? In the CC it says, Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Shadu Kobunai. The eternal love for Krishna is eternally established in the hearts of living entities. It's not something to gain from another source. When the heart is purified by hearing and chanting, then this love naturally awakens. But at the same time, in the NOD, it's also said, Shruti Smiti Puranadi Pancharatra Vidimvina Ekantiki Harir Bhakti Utpatayeva Kalpate. The point is that, yes, we're not saying that we want to replicate the Vedas. We don't even have to learn all the Vedic laws and regulations and stuff like that. We're just here for the essence. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that we disrespect the Vedas or we disregard the Vedas. Because any devotional service that you do that ignores the Sruti and the Smriti, which is the Vedas, you're going to only cause disturbance to society. So the Vedas are like a foundation, something for us to lean on, something that gives us validity, something that gives us our heritage, something that we can give homage to. But with that in place, our purpose is that we now go for the essence, which is bhakti to Krishna. Okay? Because that is the fundamental religious system for the age. Kali kale nama rupe Krishna avatar, nama hoyto hoybe sarva jagat nishtar. Right? The fun religious system for the age is the chanting of the holy names of Krishna. We don't need to spend life after life here going through different Vedic rituals and getting different powers. So bhakti is the best investment, and this is what I really want to finish on now, is the topmost investment. In chapter 6, verse 47, it talks about the topmost yogis, that they only go for bhakti. Okay? Yes. Yogi namapi sarveshan madgatinantaratmana. So I want to ask you, that what, for those of you, I'm sure there's some businessmen in the audience, some Vaishyas, what would be the, why would you say bhakti is the best investment? So instead of you asking me questions, I'm going to ask you questions. Why would you say bhakti, what makes a good investment? First thing, if you're a businessman, you want to invest in something, what are you looking at? A return, okay? What else? Maybe the time scale? Yeah, how much time do I need to invest in this investment, right? What about the simplicity of it? Is it a simple investment that I can make? So you got return, time scale, simplicity, safe, no risk, yeah? No risk. No risk investment is the best investment, right? So you got return, time scale, simplicity, and no risk. So let's look at the return. If you get to bhakti, what's the return you get? If you take to bhakti and achieve the highest goal of bhakti, what's the return for it? Huh? Krishna? I mean, Krishna's a very broad term. Let's break it down more. Huh? Love of Krishna? Was that in Brahman or Paramatman or Vaikuntha planet or five types of liberation? What is Prabhupada giving us? Is he giving us the five types of liberation? Or maybe he's giving us something even better than that? Right. He's giving us Golok Vrindavan, the highest of the high for the lowest of the low. Connection with the ultimate reserve of all pleasure. Time scale. How long does it take to attain this bhakti? Is there a time scale? Can be instantly. Can you give an example of someone who attained bhakti in an instant? Katvanga Rishi. Prabhupada literally says in the purport, he attained it in a moment. He was in the heavenly planets, helping the demigods defeat some demons. And the demigods like, well done, you can stay here, enjoy with us. And he said, how long do I have? Oh, just a moment. No, forget this, I'm going straight down. And just instantly attained, bhakti to Krishna. So time scale, you can do it in one instant. Simplicity. For doing this bhakti, do we require a lot of rules and regulations? Well, I mean, we have some basic things. We have the regulation principles, chanting 16 rounds. But when you compare it to what Krishna was telling Arjuna in chapter 6, Ashtanga Yoga, how difficult is that? You got the yama, the niyama, the pranayam, the hatha, all these things that you have to do. You have to sit in a certain place on kusha grass with your eyes half closed, focusing on the end of the nose. Very, very tricky. Arjuna himself said that this is very, very difficult for me to do. And Krishna himself even concurred, right? So this is the simplest thing. You just have to, Prabhupada said chant, dance, and feast, right? A bit more than that, but still, that's the essence of it, right? What about universality? Do you need to be a particular age to practice bhakti? No. You can be in the womb and practice bhakti. For example, Sukadev Goswami was in the womb hearing the gatha. You can be in your youth, a young little boy. Examples of young boys who practice bhakti and attain the destination? You got Prahlad Maharaj, Dhruva Maharaj. Or you can even do it in old age. Any example of a person at old age who decided to take up bhakti? In the Bhagavatam, canto one. Dhritarashtra, right? In one sense, okay, he didn't attain the highest level, but still, it gives the opportunity that yes, you can. Okay, another example is not just old age, but even at the time of death, who then attained bhakti? Ajamil, right? So whether you're in the womb, whether you're a youth, whether you're old age, everyone can take bhakti. And then the second, final thing is no risk. Is there any risk in practicing bhakti? No, even if you fall down, what happens? Do you lose everything? No, there's no loss or diminution. Neha bikama, nasusti. You just simply carry on from where you left off. So Krishna incarnated in 1486 as Mahaprabhu to give us the essence of the Vedas so that we can practice it, go back to Godhead. So we don't need to know all the ins and outs of the Vedas, but we recognize how the Vedas has given us the civilizations that are now currently existing in the world. But we have the essence, and this is what Prabhupada gave us as well. You give the essence. In fact, in the Santi Parva chapter of the Mahabharata, King Janaka actually says that memorizing all the Vedas just to keep as information in your head is just a useless thing if you do not understand the essence of it. So that's what Mahaprabhu is giving us, the essence. We don't need to know all the different slokas and the stotras of the Vedas, but as long as we pay homage to the fact that this is where it's coming from and practice our bhakti fully, that's the main thing. And the main thing is always remember Krishna, and never forget him, Smatavya Satatam Vishnur. Vismutavya na jato chet. All the other rules and regulations in the Vedas are subservient to that principle. So I'll finish there. Any last comments, questions, or queries?